Hey, Jonathan Goodman here. I have super exciting news. My book, The Obvious Choice, that I've been talking about forever, is almost here. This is published by HarperCollins. The president of Shopify endorsed it. The editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine endorsed it. This thing is going to blow the roofs off, and I'm asking that you please pre-order your copy today on your local Amazon, wherever you buy books. It's available. It's called The Obvious Choice. Hope you pre-order it. Hope you love it. Welcome back to the Obvious Choice podcast. The day has just gotten a little bit brighter because you're here, my friend.
This is overwhelming in a bullshit sort of way.
We're continuing to talk about exploration, continuing to workshop this chapter from the next book. If you guys don't know, actually, The main reason why I have this podcast is entirely selfish. Everybody says, create content for your reader, for your listener. You know, you should do everything with them in mind. It's like, nah, fuck that. This podcast is for me to be able to write books better. And so I'm so happy that you're along for the ride with me. And I hope that it's fun for you to be able to see these things, especially as the books come out. As the years are going to go on, you're going to be able to see them basically get built in real time. That hasn't started yet. That will start with The Obvious Choice coming out in January, which of course you can pre-order now. But if you've been listening to this podcast for a long time, you will have been privy to us literally figure out the name of the book on the podcast, workshop the stories and the sections multiple times. Have Amber, have Ren come in with great feedback, helping me add clarity, metaphor, story to a lot of the sections. And so that's what we're doing here. It's not every episode, but that's what we're doing here today is workshopping. This will be probably chapter 5 of the next book. And the title of the chapter most likely is Birds Never Sing in Caves. And it's really about exploration and how to add more exploration into your life. And so the section that I'll start with is called Boring, Not Vacant. And it starts with a phrase. That phrase says, there's two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. And the other is as though everything is a miracle. You see, when somebody tells me that their life is boring, I tell them, go ahead. Be boring. If by boring you mean doing things like folding the laundry or listening to podcasts on history or mathematics or chemical engineering, then keep doing that. If you mean walking the dusty stacks at used bookstores or going for coffee with friends or visiting museums and reading the placards about long-gone civilizations or touring art galleries and staring at paintings by long-dead artists or attending antique car auctions without ever bidding or collecting vinyl records or baseball cards, action figures, comics, pins, buttons, old Nintendo games, or salt and pepper shakers. All of this is fine, too. But if by boring you mean that you have no interests, that you never seek out new knowledge, I'm going to start again. Amber, maybe cut that. That'd be great. But if by boring you mean that you have no interests, that you never seek out new knowledge or learn new skills, or that you lack a passion for even the most random, useless, and otherwise uninteresting things like learning to speak Klingon or becoming the worldwide Wizard of Oz trivia champion, that all you do is sit and scroll, then yeah, that's a problem. You should stop doing nothing and start doing something. Even if it's a boring hobby, because at least it's your boring hobby. It's okay to be boring. It's not okay to be vacant. When a plane takes off, you feel its movement. But when it's in the air, even when the speed is nearly 4 times the speed of takeoff, you don't feel the movement of the plane. When it's time for the plane to land, when it's decelerating, you feel the movement again. That's because our body and mind feels changes in speed, not speed itself. I don't like big parties. I don't like staying up late. I abhor small talk. When somebody starts talking about the weather, I just become wildly disinterested in them, in being there, in anything to do with that situation. Loud noises startle me. I don't do drugs, and I drink maybe a beer a month. And for a long time, especially as a young adult, I thought that something was wrong with me. But then something changed. I began to like who I was, my books, my early bedtime, my small group of friends. And I realized that the problem was that I was trying to conform to society's view of fun instead of my own. Boring, I've discovered, is a relative term. My boring life is quite exciting, at least to me. You're only boring if you yourself think that you're uninteresting. To be less boring to yourself. Who cares what others think? This is called Isaac's Lesson. Enjoy the process is advice we hear all of the time. Right? Do the verb in order to become the noun, they say. Relish the experience, savor the journey, cherish the adventure you're told. And it's all good advice in theory. Without application, though, it's useless. So first, some helpful terminology. In linguistics, there's two types of activities. There's telic and atelic. Telic activities aim at terminal states. So getting married is telic. It's done when you're wed. Writing a book is telic. It's done when your phalange fingers the final key. Driving somewhere is telic. It's done when you arrive. When we're done this episode, I'm going to need a slow jam about a phalange fingering the final key, please.
It was very descriptive, John.
Something for you to prepare for. Atelic activities don't aim at terminal states. They don't drive towards finishing. It's the process, which never completes. Now, the same thing done differently can be either telic or atelic. For example, walking home is telic because home is the end state. Going for an aimless walk, on the other hand, is atelic. It's true that you're going to eventually stop walking, but aimless walks are never actually completed. In a future-focused society, we're trained to be telic, always striving to get there and never here, thinking about the past, driving toward the future while leaving the present curiously unoccupied. There's this parable about a Mexican fisherman. You've probably heard it before. The fisherman's boat always had several large, fresh fish in it, which caught the attention of an American investment banker on vacation. He asked the fisherman how long his catch took him. "Only a little while," the Mexican replied. "I have more than enough to support my family," he said. So the American asked him what he did with the rest of his time. "I sleep late, fish a little, play with my children, take a siesta with my wife, and stroll into the village each evening where I sip wine and play guitar with my friends," the fisherman said. "You should buy a bigger boat," the American replied. "Then you'll make more money and be able to afford a fleet of boats. And eventually you'll be able to move to Mexico City and open your own cannery." The fisherman asked how long this would take. "Oh, 15 to 20 years," said the American. "Then what?" asked the fisherman. "Then you will be rich and can retire." "And what would I do then?" the fisherman asked. "Then, my friend, you will have no worries. You could move to a small coastal fishing village where you would sleep late, fish little, play with your kids, take a siesta with your wife, and stroll to the village in the evenings where you could sip wine and play your guitar with your friends," said the American. I live in a small Mexican fishing village most winters. One morning at the gym, I met Isaac. He's a Mexican-American, was born in town, went to college in California, got some finance degree, then came back. He works out every morning with his girlfriend and his dog. At sunset, you'll find him playing spike ball at the beach with his friends. And during the day, he works at the best taco spot in town. I've never seen Isaac without a smile. He's fit, eats fresh fruit, gets free tacos, and is surrounded by people that he loves. But a part of me also knows that I wouldn't be able to do what he does. And I also wonder how long he'll be able to do it. It's too perfect. Idyllic days on repeat where the sun shines, the food's delicious, and the activities are great is nice in theory. Without contrast, however, desensitization sits in, and it leads to burnout just the same, and so I'm left with a paradox. The false allure of early retirement, of giving the middle finger to the real world and replacing it with beautifully perfect days on repeat, of golfing more than 3 days a year, and then realizing that golf kind of sucks when you do it more than 3 days a year. The problem with the Mexican fisherman story. On one hand, a project-driven life is no way to live. But there's also no way to live other than to be driven by projects. We obviously shouldn't wait to retire to buy a sailboat and sail around the world. Maybe we won't ever be able to afford it, or maybe something tragic happens and we die. Or maybe we'll finally make it to those golden years and buy the sailboat, only to discover that sailing kinda sucks. Like golf. Golf sucks. Come at me. It's a stupid game. Here's my challenge. I want to fall in love with the process and ignore the outcome, but I can't. I just can't. I'm always thinking about the outcome. Want to know what I was thinking about when I wrote this? The second that I wrote this, at 11:25 a.m. on October 28th, 2024, as I typed these exact words, I'm thinking, will this book be a success? Will it sell? Will anybody care? I once produced 3 books. I say produced because even though my name is on them, I didn't write them. The books made some money, not a lot, but enough to be a good business decision. But I learned nothing from the experience. I gained nothing from the experience. So now I don't even care about the books enough to display them on my shelf. They mean nothing to me. They were purely telic. A strategic business decision, a means to an end, something that now exists because of me, but didn't do anything for me. We had plans to do at least 5 books in the series. After 3, I said enough was enough, and I thanked the talented ghostwriter and I paid him a severance. Then I swore that it was going to be the last time that I ever did the work for the money, because even though I did get some money, I got nothing from the work. Writing the book that I'm writing right now, on the other hand, it's helped me become more of the father, the husband, the friend, the spouse, and the boss that I want to be. I'm writing about being more happy, grateful, and adventurous. I'm reading and listening and thinking about those things constantly throughout the day. And as a result, the work has changed me. I'm only about halfway through the first draft of the book. And writing this book, doing this work, has already helped me to become a better human. Work that matters is challenging. If you can't explore within your work, no matter how big or important your work is or how much money it makes you, you will burn out and it will feel empty. At the same time, waking up each day in the same bed to the same perfect weather with the same routine without any stress, without any challenging project forcing you to figure some fucking shit out is also a miserably empty experience. I used to love the parable of the Mexican fisherman. Then I took on the task of writing this book, and it forced me to think deeper about it. And that's when I thought back to Isaac and the lesson that he taught me, which is that the parable of the Mexican fisherman is nonsense. And maybe the American businessman isn't as crazy as he's made to appear. Let's pause there. I got one more section.
So there's this TV show called The Good Place, which is fantastic. Did you watch it?
You know, I love the premise. I love the first couple episodes.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of got silly. But
yeah, it was a very challenging show for me to watch because it trips on something that kind of causes like panic attacks for me. So it was very difficult for me to watch, but it was very good. But at the end, right, when they get to the good place, like every day is idyllic. Like it's exactly how they want it over and over and over again. And it can be like that forever. But spoiler alert, like they are given the option to leave and they don't know what's on the other side, but they could live this idyllic life where it's everything goes exactly the way they want. It's always fun. All food is always delicious, so on and so forth. But it becomes monotonous and boring. And so the unknown, which could be nothing, they eventually all choose to go.
There's because a word for it.
There's
a word for it. Purgatory.
Well, would it be purgatory though? That would be kind of more like where we're at. wouldn't it?
Purgatory is just this in-between space.
Well, this wouldn't even be an in-between space because this is like heaven, like their version of heaven is the good place. So something past that.
But wasn't the whole concept of the show that these people didn't quite yet make it into heaven?
They were in purgatory, but then they made it into heaven. And then something passed that. Yeah. So
the guy who wrote that show, I think he's the one who did Brooklyn Nine-Nine and a few others. And he wrote a book on ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And so that show was basically his version of the book.
Because makes sense.
Show
dives a lot at ethics. And I was so excited to read the book, and the book sucked so hard that it was like, you know what it was? It was like a deeply philosophical examination of ethics by a guy who writes TV shows. It's like, yo, if you're gonna try to write like a deep philosophical book, like you should be a deep philosophical guy. You shouldn't be a guy, you know, that writes for TV. And so it just didn't work at all. But I think ethics is the single thing that needs to be taught so much more. Hey, Jonathan Goodman, and I wanted to invite you to pre-order my next book called The Obvious Choice. This is my first traditionally published book. It's been published by HarperCollins. Sam Parr, if you listen to My First Million podcast, called it a much-needed recalibration for a business generation that's focused on the wrong thing at the wrong time. Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine, said that if you want to win in business without feeling like you need to win the internet, you gotta get this book. So why pre-order it instead of getting it when it's ready? Well, there's two reasons, really. The first is that it's really, really beneficial for me, selfishly. It helps me a lot. My publishers love it. But the second beneficial for you is you actually lock in the best ever price. No joke, I pre-ordered a book that was $40 not too long ago. And because the price went down over the pre-order period for like a day to $29.99, when the book arrived to me on the day of the launch, I actually got refunded by Amazon $10. Because when you pre-order a book on Amazon, you lock in the lowest price ever. So if Amazon ever lowers the price, which they often do, you're gonna get that price and get refunded, whatever the difference is from when you pre-ordered it. So there's benefit to you, there's benefit to me. Please pre-order the book, The Obvious Choice, anywhere you buy books, but Amazon gives you this other benefit. Hope that you love it. Hope you're good. Progressively than it is.
Agreed.
So much more aggressively than it is. But yeah, The Good Place was a fascinating premise for sure. I couldn't watch it after. But I also just have no patience really for TV as a whole.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
But the way it ended made me think about what you were
interesting. I
about.
Didn't even know that that's how it ended, that they all chose to basically go for the unknown and the more difficult. But it makes sense. It's like, it's interesting because in The Obvious Choice, I talk about stories and I talk about how all of these, you know, the Steve Jobs, the Warren Buffetts, the Elon Musk, all of these business stories that we fetishize about, well, we only accept a small part of the story. And even these amazing stories that are told of in the book, I give the example of a podcaster who's on stage, who's talked about on stage, about how after 6 years, they finally had their break. And got a million downloads, and what an amazing story of perseverance and of sticking through. And it's like, yeah, it is. But also, a dude worked for free for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And the only reason, the literal only reason why he's being spoken about on stage is because he's the outlier where it actually worked out. There is a serious survivorship bias to these stories. And so what we learn about story is that what makes for a very good story is very rarely what makes for a very good case study. Mm-hmm. Because the other part that you don't hear about in the story is that, yeah, he got a million downloads. So what? Is he now on a private island somewhere with fuzzy slippers and models eating endless supplies of caviar? I don't know, but our mind makes up the ending that this dude's life is perfect now. Whereas, who knows? Like, I don't even know who he was talking about, right? It doesn't matter. And so when we talk about these parables, like the Mexican fisherman, I've shared it. I've repeated it. Yet another case where I've repeated something and shared something, and then I really thought about it, and I was like, no, that's actually complete and utter nonsense. But it makes for a really good Pablo Coelho self-help book. You know, and that story actually, if you trace it back to its origins, actually wasn't a Mexican fisherman. It was actually a Portuguese fisherman, because that story does come from Paulo Coelho, the author who wrote The Alchemist. It's this, and he's Portuguese. So the story actually originates with him, the parable. But it's something that everybody kind of nods their head on and is like, yeah, no, of course, that's perfect. Why would we work so hard to get to the same place we're already in today? It's like, because the work is what matters. Because the work, if you choose the right work, if you find the atelic joy in the telic activity, then your cup will be full.
This is
that's what matters. You cannot live, you cannot exist in that type of idyllic existence day in and day out.
This is the most common client coach disconnect, right?
What's that?
The desire for the outcome versus the necessity of the becoming, right? People want to be something, but they don't want to become something. They just want to be it, right? And the becoming is where all the change happens. Climbing the mountain to get to the peak isn't the same as being helicoptered into the summit, right? What? The location is not what matters. The method by which you arrive at the location is the whole deal. And this is the most common disconnect between coaches and clients in any change process. Coaches straight up atelic, and thank you for that word. I'll be overusing it from now on. And the clients are almost overtly telic. They don't get it.
I try to stay away from this like philosophical jargon.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that there's any reason why intelligent readers should be forced to learn new words. and so this is a big problem that I have, you know, reading these dense philosophy books that I read sometimes. But when I came across this one, it was so it's so precise and easy to understand. It's like, yeah, a lot of activities that we strive towards have an endpoint, and it's actually not the action. It's the action within the activity,
mm-hmm.
and not the activity itself. The same activity can actually have an endpoint or not have an endpoint. And so, you know, I'm writing is atelic. I'm writing a book is telic.
Mm-hmm.
The part that I didn't include here that I have to think about a little bit more, it was kind of one of those things where like the author of the source material kind of came to this conclusion. I was like, I kind of feel like that's a bit of a stretch. Like a lot of philosophy comes up with very logically correct conclusions that are so clearly psychologically incorrect. And so I have to fight that sometimes and like really think about it. So what the author said about these things is the biggest benefit about atelic activities is because they never end, they therefore have boundless energy. You'll never exhaust yourself doing them because they can never end. And I'm kind of like, I mean, I kind of get what you're getting at, but I don't know if that's quite true.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm going to say no.
I don't know if that's quite true.
That feels categorically incorrect.
Yeah, it feels wildly wrong. Anyway. Like just absolutely bat shit crazily wrong.
Yeah.
I'm not even on the fence about that one.
Okay. So I'm not going to, I have that in my notes to like consider about how I might add that into the section and be like, and by the way, you also get boundless energy, but I feel like that's some, like eat, pray, love shit that I don't really want to include in. I'm trying so hard to not have this book fall into the eat, pray, love shit type trap. of just using all of these nice words and like, nah, you just manifest it and like life will work out and things will happen. It's like, you had like four fucking divorces, lady. Like, I mean, what are you manifesting? So I don't know. I'm trying to get away from that.
Bubba's going to be like,
I'm gonna manifest finding a good man. You found three. I don't know the story. I don't know if she's had that many divorces or not. If you're listening, whoever you are that wrote that book, I don't remember your name. Then I apologize, but I'm glad that you enjoyed your time in Bali. Okay, so let's move on. Papa, my 78-year-old mother-in-law, got her first tattoo last winter in Nicaragua. And it's not a small one. It's a phoenix rising out of the ashes that now covers her entire upper back. The tattooist got out of jail recently. His face was covered in ink. They met because she had a hair appointment and asked him for directions on the street, and he walked her over to it wearing socks, and she liked his energy. As we move through our 30s and 40s and 50s, we tend to get more cynical, bearish. We get more specialized in our work, and as a result, more strict in our ways. But then something seems to happen when people get a lot older. Because of their limited time horizons, the elderly, and this is in quotes, become attuned to the minute pleasures that younger people often are only aware of if they've been deprived of them, like a morning cup of coffee, a warm bed on a winter night, brightly colored bird feeding in the lawn, an unexpected letter from a friend, even a favorite song on the radio. That comes from the Cornell University Legacy Project, which is a fascinating project. They interviewed like thousands of people basically in old age homes and on their deathbeds and came up with more or less 10 conclusions. I know, Ren, you're super into that kind of stuff.
Because I'm old.
Yeah, we've spoken about it. I mean, you are. But
it's the oldness.
It's the oldness. How was Prohibition, by the way?
It was interesting because Capone had these Prohibition islands off Newfoundland. You'll never believe it. I'll tell you the story another time.
Yeah, okay. I look forward to it.
Yeah.
Old age, of course, brings with it a kind of liberation from the doubt, from the anxiety, from the restlessness of youth. So with the body and the energy of a young bull, I want the worldview of an old bear. I want to avoid the trap of reactivity, of getting worn down by taking it on all angles, to attune my senses to even the smallest details, to not wait until the sun is setting on my life to stop and watch the damn sunset. Allison yelled at me at one point. She said, you told the waiter that I was pregnant? So here's the story behind that. I finished writing The Obvious Choice, overlooking the Pacific Ocean from a luxury hotel in Mexico. Most days I had the place to myself. And so first off, here's a travel hack for you. The bed's the most expensive part of any hotel. So don't stay overnight at fancy hotels. Don't pay for the bed. Rent a place down the street and then go to the hotel for your coffee. So where I wrote every day, coffee cost 80 pesos as opposed to 60 pesos in town and came with a free refill. Rene, who's my server, knew exactly how I like it. Black with honey. Ren, that's for you.
Thank you.
After 4 months, it goes through my head too as I'm writing this. I'm like, shit, I'm going to have to say this on the podcast and Ren's going to be there. And I'm going to say black with honey and he's going to look at me and wonder if I'm going to say something. And do I even want to include this line?
But that's actually
how I like my coffee. And
I'd wonder more if you didn't say something, John. That was actually very natural.
After four months of this, I said goodbye and I told Renee that I'd be back next year, but wasn't sure when because Allison was pregnant. We slapped hands. I gave him a bro hug, complete with the two obligatory back pats.
Nice.
I said, thank you for taking care of me. I meant it. And that was it. Allison ended up losing the baby. It was our sixth miscarriage. By then, we had learned to wait a while before sharing the news with anybody. But I had to tell somebody. I was bursting at the seams to tell somebody. And so I told Renee. My parents never knew about that pregnancy. My best friend never knew about that pregnancy. The only person that knew that Allison was pregnant was Renee, my waiter at the hotel. It was harmless. We were leaving. Who was he going to tell? You see, when you're exploring, sometimes you'll tell a stranger a secret you're boasting at the seams to share but cannot tell even to your closest friend. The retired dentist you're sitting next to on an airplane, another couple hiking to the same waterfall, a tattooist without shoes, or Renee. Becoming unknown is a way to test being a different version of yourself. I've thought a lot about why I love exploring so much, and it has little to do with seeing beautiful things and less to do with sitting on airplanes. What I love about exploration is that it breaks me out of my way of being that I've accepted as my normal, if only by my acquiescence to it. When was the last time you took an art class, just because? In Toronto, Allison would never give herself permission. It's too much to do, too many people to see, the days pass too quickly. But whenever we're in a new place, she explores that side of herself and takes lessons from a local artisan. Crochet, silver, resin, whatever's there. Everywhere you turn, you're being limited. But this can change. You can change your programming. But you can't just intellectually know yourself. You must also experientially know yourself. Shake off the shackles that remind you who you are or who you think others think that you are. And explore being somebody else for even the shortest bit of time. This is essential for your creativity and perspective. You have to get lost every now and then. You've got to get out there. Now, there doesn't mean that you have to get on a plane. There is simply anywhere outside of your routine. An 85-year-old who learned that he was dying once said that if I had to live my life over again, I'd try to make more mistakes next time. I wouldn't try to be so perfect. So here's my recommendation to you. Throw out your maps. Don't look it up in advance. Be willing to learn on the fly. You'll make mistakes. You'll scrape your knees. You're going to lose your way and have to backtrack, which is a good thing. Burns more calories. The reason why I love exploration so much is simple. It's because exploration is the process of being led gently back to yourself. Wayne, you got that slow jam for me?
What was the phrase? Your finger licking good?
Phalange fingering the final key of a book.
Phalange fingering the final key of a book. Oh, that's a mouthful, isn't it?
Phalange is a very sexual word. It's a very unsexual thing, but it's a very sexual word.
And it's phalange fingering the final note of a... It just sounds so salacious. Yeah. So I met this cutie in Nicaragua.
Sing yourself into the moonlight.
I'm just going to slow jam it. I don't know that I'm going to sing. I don't have the melody. But I did meet this cutie in Nicaragua. And from across the room, we locked eyes, baby, and I knew one thing was for sure. She wanted to go off and do a little spelunking, and she wanted to explore the cave. And that cave was neither boring nor empty. I can tell you that right now.
Okay. Tell me more.
She was thinking more along the lines of an atelic interaction, and I was thinking strictly telic, baby. I had no idea that she would get me home so fast, and when I inquired as to how that happened, she said it was my phalange fingering the final note of our cave exploration. I can dig it. You've been obvious choiced.
Can you dig it?
I can dig it.
Oh my God.
See you next time.